Weaving the threads of art, culture, and history, this week Martha Hawley creates an oral tapestry.
In 1904, the Irish writer James Joyce left Dublin with his partner, Nora Barnacle. They traveled to Trieste, now part of Italy. It was an accidental destination. Joyce had been promised a job as an English teacher at the Berlitz School in Zurich. But no job was available when they arrived in Zurich, and the director of the school suggested that they try the Trieste office. Trieste at the time was a thriving cosmopolitan port city on the Adriatic Sea. Trieste was no less than the third most important town in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. With few interruptions, Joyce and Nora stayed in Trieste between 1905 and the outbreak of the First World War. Their children, Lucia and Giorgio, were born there. Trieste was also the cradle for the characters Leopold and Molly Bloom, also for Stephen Dedalus. Joyce wrote short stories and a portrait of the artist as a young man in its entirety. He conceived and began Ulysses. James Joyce participated fully in the coffee and drinking culture in Trieste's grand old cafes, such as the Tommaseo and the San Marco. They're still operating in full glory. John McCourt is a current Irish resident of Trieste and director of the Trieste Joyce School. McCourt's book, The Years of Bloom, introduces Joyce as the most celebrated, the most influential, and the most controversial literary figure of the 20th century.
If there's one name that people who've probably never read a book, if there's one literary name that most people know, it's that name, James Joyce. Many of them don't know why they're so aware of the name. Some of them think he's a writer of dirty books, books that in some way are scandalous. And James Joyce's writings, particularly from Ulysses on, are just simply the most revolutionary writing that took place in the 20th century. And they changed the way in which we read. They change the way in which writers tend to write or try to write. And when he came to Finnegan's Wake, he not only is the narrative strange, but every single word in the narrative becomes strange. And no writer, no serious writer now, can sit down and try to write without being aware of the presence and of the stylistic revolutions carried out by James Joyce. He's also hugely controversial because an awful lot of people find his writing so difficult.
From dark Rosa Lane, a sigh and a weep. From Lesbia Lucia, the beam in her eye. From lone Coogan Barry, his arrow of song. From Sean Kelly's anagram, a blush at the name. From I Am the Sullivan, the trumpeting tramp. From Suffering Dufferin, the sit of her style. From Kathleen May Vernon, her Mebber fair efforts. From Phil the Pot Curran, his Scotch love Macreather. From him, Opus 2. Phil Adolphus the Weary, oh the Leery, oh! From Samuel Lever, or Damn You Well Lover, that jolly old Molly Bit, or that bored saunter by, from Tom Finn, again's weak tribe's loss of strength, to his so wheel, from The Wedding on the Green, our girlies, the greatness of Joy Boys, from Pat Mellon, Tom Mellon, Don Maldon, a slipstick picnic made in Moat from Muldoon's. The solid man saved by his silly woman.
Joyce's period in Trieste is utterly crucial for his development as a writer. Now, we've got to remember that when he came here, he was just 22 years of age. 22 years of age is the age of Stephen Dedalus in Ulysses. 38 is the age of Leopold Bloom in Ulysses. So, in those intervening years, Joyce lived the experiences and met the people who enabled him to create the character of Leopold Bloom. In other words, he left Ireland with Stephen Dedalus in his pocket, and throughout his time here in the heart of Europe, in Trieste, he was able to develop the character of Leopold Bloom, who was probably his richest and most carefully wrought character.
For James Joyce, the subject was worthy of a very different style of commentary, as he wrote in Ulysses.
16 years before, in 1888, when Bloom was of Stephen's present age, Stephen was 6. 16 years after, in 1920, when Stephen would be of Bloom's present age, Bloom would be 54. In 1936, when Bloom would be 70 and Stephen 54, their ages initially in the ratio of 16 to 0 would be as 17.5 to 13.5, the proportion increasing and the disparity diminishing according as arbitrary future years were added. For if the proportion existing in 1883 had continued immutable, conceiving that to be possible, till then, 1904, when Stephen was 22, Bloom would be 374. And in 1920, when Stephen would be 38, as Bloom then was, Bloom would be 646. While in 1952, when Stephen would have attained the maximum post-diluvian age of 70, Bloom, being 1,190 years alive, having been born in the year 714, would have surpassed by 221 years the maximum antediluvian age, that of Methuselah, 969 years, while, if Stephen would continue to live until he would attain that age in the year 3072 AD, Bloom would have been obliged to have been alive 83,300 years, having been obliged to have been born in the year 81,396 BC.
The Triassine years were vital because they were the years which formed him as an artist. He himself said to one of his teacher friends here in Trieste that his personality had been formed in Trieste, and that Trieste was his second country. And they're very strong words, really, if you think of it. He looked on Trieste as a country, as a place apart, which was both Austro-Hungary and was also Italy. Because Trieste in those years, of course, was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but it was a city in which irredentism, Italian nationalism, was very strong. And so Joyce lived in this city and he observed. Firstly, he observed how Trieste was similar to Dublin, a city on the sea, a city with the hills in the background, a city with a strong nationalist spirit, a city with a great culture of song and of music. Song in the theatres, in the opera houses like the Teatro Verdi, but also song on the streets. A city where newspaper culture was very, very important. A city where books were important and where there was an intense amount of literary activity.
You've written about how the language in Finnegan's Wake is this amazingly exaggerated version of the Triestino dialect. How did he do that?
The language of Trieste, the Triestine dialect, is a composite language. It's a language which absorbed elements from so many other languages and cultures. It's brimming with words from, obviously, from Italian. It's based in the Venetian dialect. Got words from Croatian, from the Slav languages, from German, from English. For example, the word in English, son of a bitch, or the word son of a bitch, you can find in the Triestine dialect dictionary as son of a bitch. And that came through the sailors who were here and who used it, and it was absorbed into the local dialect. It's just one little example of a word that came in. So Joyce, when he eventually came to write Finnegan's Wake, he too created a language which, in a sense, was a world. It was a language which was totally personal to him, but which absorbed so many of the other languages which he had heard throughout his years on the continent. So no single word was without foreign echoes. And so what happens in Finnegan's Wake is that Joyce uses as his base language English, but it's an English which is brimming, as they say, with other traditions and other words, in which no one word can be reduced to one single meaning that you can say definitely that's what it means. So Triestine was just like a model for him then, because as new population groups had come to Trieste, they too had brought their words to bear on the local language and they had enriched it. And so Joyce, I suppose, found the use of that Triestine something which was, in a sense, liberating.
And there she was, Anna Livia, She didn't catch a winkle of sleep, purling around like a chit of a child. Wenda Wanda, a finger thick in a lapsummer skirt and damason cheeks, for to Ishim Bonzor, to her dear Dubba Dan, with new frittees and salt from his Maggie's. And an odd time she'd cook him up blooms of fisk and lay to his heart's foot her medry aegis, yayis, and Stainish beacons on toast, and a cuppenhave so wishy-washy of Greenland's tay, or a zoopgan of kafu mokau and sable or sikiang sukri, or his ale of ferns in true art pewter, and a shinko bread, ham jambo barna, for to plaze that man, hog, stay his stomacher, till the pyrrhic knees shrunk to nutmeg graters, while her toggle joints shuck with goit, and as rash as she'd rust with her peak load of vivers up on her sieve, met our weirer rage, its swales and reezes, my hardy heck, he'd cast them from him with a star of scorn, as much as to say you sow and you soz. And if he didn't peg the plateau on her tawe, believe you me, she was safe enough. And then she'd ask to vistula him, the heart bowed down, or the...
The other crucial thing, I suppose, about his time in Trieste was his close encounters with the Jewish community here. The Jewish community in Trieste was far more sizable and important than the Jewish community in Ireland. So here he was meeting people, and he was able to feed his fascination for all things Jewish. And so it was here that he found the elements that made Leopold Bloom. Because Leopold Bloom is, of course, a Dubliner, but he's much more than a Dubliner. He's a Jewish Dubliner with Hungarian roots, whose memory, whose familial memory, is of Middle Europe and of Vienna. And Joyce, in order to gather these materials, was drawing on people that he knew here in Trieste. One of his sources was, of course, the local novelist Italo Svevo, who was a great source of material.
The half-Jewish Svevo was older. He had married into a wealthy family. His wife was haughty, and she looked down on Nora. There was always a degree of class friction between the two writers. Svevo's novels had been ignored in Trieste. Then Joyce came along and said that Italo Svevo was an important writer. Svevo offered his appreciation of Joyce in return. In addition to supplying James Joyce with information on Jewish life, he loaned him money. At times, Joyce was ready to give up in desperation. Svevo got him back to his desk, particularly to write a portrait of the artist as a young man.
Towards dawn, he awoke. Oh, what sweet music! His soul was all dewy wet. Over his limbs, in sleep, pale, cool waves of light had passed. He lay still, as if his soul lay amid cool waters, conscious of faint, sweet music. His mind was waking slowly to a tremulous morning knowledge, a morning inspiration. A spirit filled him, pure as the purest water, sweet as dew, moving as music. But how faintly it was inbreathed, how passionlessly, as if the seraphim themselves were breathing upon him. His soul was waking slowly, fearing to awake wholly. It was that windless hour of dawn when madness wakes and strange plants open to the light and the moth flies forth silently. An enchantment of the heart. The night had been enchanted. In a dream or vision he had known the ecstasy of seraphic life. Was it an instant of enchantment only, or long hours and days and years and ages?
He was intensely at home in this city, even though, of course, he found life very, very difficult here. And he wrote a very small and largely unknown novelette, or a short prose poem called Giacomo Joyce, which is the only major Joyce work which is set outside of Dublin. And in a sense, this work, Giacomo Joyce, is testimony to the importance of Trieste in Joyce's creative consciousness. Because in that book, we read of the central character Giacomo's infatuation with a young Triestine woman. And that young Triestine woman, in a sense, symbolizes all of those elements in Trieste which so fascinated Joyce. She is Jewish. She is very, very sophisticated, very fashionable, very beautiful. She speaks several languages. She plays instruments. She's an altogether more sophisticated and cultured woman than his partner, Nora Barnacle, could ever have been. And in a sense, Trieste was an altogether more sophisticated city than the Dublin which he had left behind. And it was his sojourn in this place which allowed him make Dublin into a European, a truly European city in Ulysses, not simply the provincial city that he abandoned in and described so well in Dubliners, but a city in which all of Europe echoes. We shouldn't forget about the fact that when he came here, he was nobody. He had published very, very little, and he was essentially yet another starving English language teacher. And the struggle that he endured, particularly in the first 10 years here, in order to keep the family, keep the family in food, to keep them to survive, was intense. He taught a lot of hours in the Berlitz School. He was often badly paid. He gave an awful lot of private lessons. He did a lot of translations. In other words, he had an awful lot of distractions from his writing. His problems were eased, let us say, when he had the very good idea in 1905 of inviting his brother Stanislaus here to join him. Now, Stanislaus was, in a sense, everything that James Joyce was not. He was an intensely responsible young man who believed in paying his bills, who believed in turning up for his lessons on time, who believed in correcting the homework that his students did for him, whereas Joyce was far more carefree about his responsibilities. And it was really Stanislaus, young Stanny, who came out here at just 20 years of age. It was he more than Joyce who kept the bread on the table, who looked after Nora and the children, who saw to it that they were fed and clothed. Joyce, on the other hand, could very often forget about his responsibilities, go drinking here in the heart of the old city, the Città Vecchia, as it's called in Italian, go drinking at 6 o'clock in the evening to be carried home at 2 in the morning. Or, alternatively, he would take himself off to the opera. We know, for example, in 1908 that Joyce went to see La Bohème 8 times in about 2 weeks. This he did in a period when, of intense cold, when the window in their bathroom was broken. He didn't get the window repaired, he went to the opera. Why did he go to the opera? Because he found it moving and intensely enriching experience, and because in some way it probably fed his writing. And that was what drove Joyce. He put all his genius into his writing, and his family certainly paid a price for this. So there's an awful lot of tragedy around Joyce. There's a terrible story in Stanislaus Joyce's Triestine Book of Days, which is his day-to-day diary, which he kept here in Trieste from 1907 to 1909, of Joyce being invited to give a lecture in the local Chamber of Commerce here in Piazza della Borsa, and he borrowed a jacket from Stanislaus, and he borrowed a coat from his director, his boss in the Berlitz School, and he looked the part, and he went off to give his lecture. As he was going in with Stanislaus, Stanislaus spotted out of the corner of his eye, in the shadows, Nora, who had come along to have a look at the men going in. And he rushed over to her and said, "What are you doing here? You haven't got suitable clothes to be seen at a thing like this." And he gave her the price of a cinema ticket and told her to disappear. So they were very almost ashamed of Nora, of her shabby dress, and they didn't want that side of things to be seen. But Joyce, yes, he gave the impression of coming from a moneyed family, to the extent that the owner of the Berlitz School tried to sell the school to him, convinced that in some way this man, who was continually borrowing money and advances from his salary, would be able to come up with the money from Ireland to buy the school.
What about Nora? What was she doing all this time in Trieste?
Nora is quite a controversial character, also because they've just presented this film, Nora, with Susan Lynch in the title role and Ewan McGregor playing Joyce, in which they have, I suppose, tried to give a fuller version of Nora's story. and created some sort of a hero or heroine, which is Nora. I have to say this is a reading that I don't really go along with. Nora met Joyce in 1904. She was a chambermaid in Finn's Hotel in Dublin, a pretty respectable position. But she was a girl who didn't really know what to do with her life. And so Joyce came along, and they fell in love. And he suggested that they embark on this adventure in Europe, that they depart together, and that they did, 4 months after their first meeting in June of 1904. And she was in no way his intellectual match. She had very little interest in his writing. In fact, she often said it was a shame that he gave up singing, which he was much better at. She found it very hard to make ends meet. She was brought to this city of Trieste. She didn't speak a word of Italian or of Triestine. And initially she had huge resistance towards fitting in. And then, within the space of a couple of years, she had two children in very trying circumstances. So she had a hard time, a very solitary time, and traditionally the wife kept the family together. Nora, to some extent, assumed this role of keeping the family together, but she was a dreadful housekeeper. She was a terrible cook. In fact, she rarely cooked. They nearly always dined out. And she was as bad as Joyce himself in terms of flamboyance, very often. And yet, at the same time, it's hard not to have a lot of sympathy for her. Because there she was, just a couple of months after her child had been born, taking in ironing for the Svevo family, for the Schmitz family, while Joyce was out teaching lessons. But she did what she could. She also, unknowingly, I suppose, was a huge source of material for Joyce. He was recycling everything that she was telling him. And she is the single most important influence behind Molly Bloom. Molly Bloom's whole way of talking is very very close to Nora's own way of talking, or way of writing as we see it if we were to read her letters.
Ah, yes, I know them well. Who was the first person in the universe before there was anybody that made it all? Who? That they don't know. Neither do I, so there you are. They might as well try to stop the sun from rising tomorrow. The sun shines for you, he said, the day we were lying among the rhododendrons on the Howth Head, in the grey tweed suit and the straw hat, the day I got him to propose to me. Yes. First I gave him a bit of seed cake out of my mouth, and it was leap year, like now. Yeah. 16 years ago, my God. After that long kiss, I near lost my breath. Yes. He said I was a flower of the mountain. Yes, so we are all flowers, all a woman's body. Yes, that was one true thing he said in his life, and the sun shines for you today. Yes, that was why I liked him, because I saw he understood or felt what a woman is, and I knew I could always get round him, and I gave him all the pleasure I could leading him on till he asked me to say yes, and I wouldn't answer first, only looked out over the sea and the sky.
Joyce and Nora's intense relationship lasted until his death in 1941. Their tie was passionate, but there were also periods of coolness and strain. Nora would threaten to leave him. Worse still, she threatened to have the children baptized, a horrific idea to Joyce. And yet he frequently visited the churches and synagogues of all persuasions in Trieste.
Umberto Eco said very correctly that Joyce lost the faith, but he never lost the religious obsession. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. Joyce himself, in Finnegan's Wake, refers to Jimmy the chapel-goer. And he's probably referring to himself here, because he loved visiting churches. We know that when he was here in Trieste, he visited very often the Jewish synagogue. He visited the Greek Orthodox temple. He visited the Serb Orthodox church. And he also went to Easter services in the Catholic churches here. And I think he struggled with questions of faith a lot more than we perhaps sometimes realize. He was, of course, brought up by the Jesuits. And he said, if you want to understand me, you must remember that I was brought up by the Jesuits and that my mind is a mind constructed by the Jesuits. It's a Jesuitical form of thought. So, Jesuitical in the form of a very, very convoluted, if we like, a very complicated form of thinking. Whether he believed or not, I'm not saying, because he probably didn't. If anything, he in Finnegan's Wake, he tries to become God himself in the way he created this whole strange world of words, in which each word is a world. But his Catholic upbringing in Ireland, he never got away from that. He never got away, for example, from his sense of guilt, of Catholic guilt. In Finnegan's Wake, he refers to storytelling as the joy of guilty confession.
What points of contact existed between these languages and between the peoples who spoke them? The presence of guttural sounds, diacritic aspirations, epenthetic and servile letters in both languages, their antiquity, both having been taught on the plain of Shinar 242 years after the deluge in the seminary instituted by Phineas Pharsae, descendant of Noah, progenitor of Israel, and ascendant of Heber and Herimon, progenitors of Ireland. Their archaeological, genealogical, hagiographical, exegetical, homiletic, toponomastic, historical and religious literatures comprising the works of rabbis and Chaldees, Torah, Talmud, Mishnah and Gemara, Masor, Pentateuch, Book of the Dun Cow, Book of the Ballymote, Garland of Howth, Book of Kells. Their dispersal, persecution, survival and revival. The isolation of their synagogical and ecclesiastical rites in Ghetto, St. Mary's Abbey, and Mass House, Adam and Eve's Tavern. The proscription of their national costumes in penal laws and Jewish dress acts. The restoration in Channa David of Zion and the possibility of Irish political autonomy or devolution. What anthem did Bloom chant partially in anticipation of that multiple, ethnically irreducible consummation? Kolod Baliwar, Punimma, Nefesh, Yehudi, Homija.
Joyce didn't want to leave Trieste. Joyce left Trieste several times and always came back of his own volition. He left in 1906 because he thought a job in Rome would make life easier for him. As simple as that. It was a terrible miscalculation. He went to work in a bank and he was miserable, and he came back here after 7 months, describing his period in Rome as a folly. He came back 3 times from Ireland when he had gone back there on holiday. And after World War I, after his period in Zurich, he came back here fully with the intention of staying indefinitely. But Joyce left Trieste for a very simple reason. That is that Trieste was no longer part, after the First World War, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It had become part of Italy. And almost overnight, it had become a provincial capital. No longer was it the cosmopolitan place which was open to people from all the ends of Europe, but a city which was in immediate decline from the moment it became part of Italy. And Joyce realized, having spent a period in Zurich, and he realized partly because Ezra Pound told him and insisted with him, that he couldn't launch a career, an international writing career, from what had become a backwater. And so, reluctantly, he boarded the train with Nora and with the 2 children and headed for Paris. But he never forgot Trieste. He described himself as an exile, not only from Ireland, but also from Trieste. Ter gestis exul, he says in one of his letters, describing himself. And he continued to remember fondly his happy days in Trieste, and he almost became nostalgic about Trieste. He said somewhere, "I cannot begin to give you the flavour of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was a ramshackle affair, but it was charming, gay, and I experienced more kindnesses during my time in Trieste than anywhere before or since." And that's an amazing tribute for him to pay to a city where he really suffered an awful lot.